welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in Faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Thursday, February 27th, we're studying 1 Samuel chapter 14, verses 1 to 52. In today's text, Jonathan strikes a blow against the Philistines with the Lord's help, but King Saul's foolish vow keeps the victory from being greater. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us regular guest, Pastor Carl Roth. Pastor Roth serves at Grace Lutheran Church in Elgin, Texas. Pastor Roth, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
As we get started today, Pastor, give us the context. What do we need to know as we prepare to look at this chapter?
Well, 1 Samuel is the transition from the period of the judges to the period of the kings. And Samuel, you know, had been opposed to the idea of the kings, but the Lord tells him in chapter 8, you know, the people want a king, and so they're not rejecting you, Samuel. They're rejecting me as being king over them, and give them what they want, right? But then also give them all this warning about what's going to happen when they get a king. And I think today we do get a glimpse into how things go wrong once you have a king. Now, the Lord had also promised that he would deliver his people from Philistine domination through the kings that he would send. So that's in chapter 7 and chapter 9. And so we'll see today Jonathan actually trusting that promise that the Lord would be with his king and his people. And Saul not so much trusting that promise, but kind of doing his own thing. Saul had been anointed as king kind of as an obvious choice. You know, he was taller than everyone else. He was more handsome. So like from a worldly perspective, he seemed like an ideal choice. But one interesting thing about Saul is just he never shows much sign of spirituality. He does not seem to be a man of deep or strong faith. And I would say he turns out not to be much of a prophet, priest, or king. Because he does, you know, initially the Holy Spirit comes upon him and he's prophesying and people are like, this seems out of character. This is a little bit odd, right? So he's not really a prophet. He tries to be a priest in 1 Samuel 13, the immediate chapter before this. So Samuel hadn't shown up after 7 days. And so Saul's, well, I guess I better do the priest thing myself. And so he begins the sacrifices. This actually is what's going to lead to Saul losing the kingdom, his attempt to take on a priestly role. And then today we're going to see him not being such a great king. But I'd also point out that not everything about Saul is negative. He was a humble man. Samuel says that Saul was little in his own eyes. So he wasn't a boastful guy. He actually ends up hiding among the baggage when the Lord announced him to be king. And so the Lord had to reveal him. That is something worthy of imitation, not being a braggart and boastful. He was also a powerful warrior. And as today, at the end of today's text, we'll see he was a good military recruiter. It says when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he attached him to himself. He knew talent when he saw it. We also can see, you know, that in contrast with David, Saul was not a polygamist. He was a monogamist. We do find out in 2 Samuel that he had a concubine. He wasn't sexually pure and blameless. But, you know, compared to David's family or Solomon's family, he was much simpler in his way of life. And then also, I think you do see Saul is much more serious about disciplining his family than David would be. And we see it, you know, today in today's lesson, that he's willing even to put his son to death. And that this is not the right course of action. But we do see right in Deuteronomy that the Lord did require that fathers be very severe in disciplining their sons if they went astray. So I think Saul is kind of like a mixed bag, just like all of us, right? He's fallible, but he's also capable of being used by the Lord to do good things. And that's an important thing to keep in mind throughout this text, is the Lord is always working together all for good for those who love God and are called according to his purposes.
In this text, the primary contrast with Saul is going to be his own son, Jonathan, I think.
Right.
And as you pointed out with David not being the greatest father, as we'll learn to know him later in 1 and 2 Samuel, it is striking just thinking through the fathers and sons that you meet in this in these two books. And so far, they just haven't been as predictable as you'd like them to be. Eli, you know, he was a mixed bag too, but largely faithful, had two very wicked sons. You know, Samuel, a faithful guy, has sons who don't live up to him. Here you've got the opposite, where Saul's not the best character in the world, but his son Jonathan proves to be very faithful. Later, David will be a faithful man, but his sons don't always live up. It's just interesting how those things don't always line up like you think they should.
Well, you know, as every parent, I guess, worries, you know, we do wish that there was like this recipe for perfection in families and that we could always count on it. But, you know, in Ezekiel, it's emphatic that, you know, the father is not going to be punished for the crimes of his son, and the sons are not going to be punished for the crimes of the father among God's people. Now, it's a different story amongst the wicked, right? Mm. But at the same time, among God's people, each man has to stand on his own two feet. Each man has to believe for himself, and each man will stand before the Lord and Lord's judgment. I think we can learn a lot of great lessons about parenting from the Old Testament.
Yeah.
And we can recognize too much severity or too much laxness. I don't know if we draw too many conclusions from today's text. I just want to avoid, kind of like Judas, you know, he's not ever really a great example. And especially in today's text, I don't think there's a single thing we want to imitate from Saul, is there?
I don't think so. I was listening to this along as I was driving with a couple of the boys in the back seat, and especially later when Saul says he's about to kill Jonathan, they said, "Wait a second, Dad, pause that. Let's talk about what's happening here." So no, I don't know that there's anything in this text that seems worthy of imitation from Saul, other than maybe the moment where he's going to build an altar, the first real evidence of his spiritual life. But yeah, he's not the.
Isn't that too little too late?
It seems.
I don't know. I think I've already harvested the most positive thing, and that is that when he, at the very end of this chapter, when he saw any strong men or any valiant man, he attached him to himself. So he knows talent when he sees it.
That's true. All right, let's go ahead and get to know Jonathan a little bit better in this text and see how that contrasts with the way Saul reigns as king. So this is 1 Samuel 14, beginning at verse 1. One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave at Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men, including Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord, in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Within the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on the one side and a rocky crag on the other side. The name of the one was Bozez, the name of the other, Senna. The one crag rose on the north in front of Michmash, and the other on the south in front of Geba. Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few." And his armor-bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I am with you, heart and soul." Then Jonathan said, "Behold, we will cross over to the men, and we will show ourselves to them. If they say to us, 'Wait until we come to you,' then we will stand still in our place, and we will not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hand. And this shall be the sign to us." So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, "Look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves." And the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor-bearer and said, "Come up to us, and we will show you a thing." And Jonathan said to his armor-bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and his armor-bearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan, and his armor-bearer killed them after him. And that first strike, which Jonathan and his armor-bearer made, killed about 20 men within, as it were, half a furrow's length in an acre of land. And there was a panic in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and even the raiders trembled. The earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. I'll pause there. That takes us through verse 15 of the text. Pastor Roth, we met Jonathan in the previous chapter. We know he's an important warrior in Saul's army. He's one of the one who actually has a sword. Nobody else around has a sword except Saul and Jonathan. And we learned quite a bit about him from this text. Tell us, start talking to us about Jonathan.
Yeah, so that is a strange detail, isn't it? That they didn't have any weapons. I guess that really does set the stage for the Lord doing battle for them.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jonathan does have a weapon, but he's not relying upon his armor or his sword. I would say that this chapter begins with a somewhat similar to the David and Uriah scene, right? You got David who's in Jerusalem when it's time for kings to go out and do battle. And so he's not really doing what he's supposed to be doing as a king. Here we've got Saul kind of hanging out and hiding either in a pomegranate cave or under a pomegranate tree, depending on how you translate it. I couldn't find any details about the history of pomegranate caves, but I mean, I can imagine it would be a place where you'd store them because it'd be cool. Sure. And dry, right? Yeah. But anyway, one way or the other, he's not really doing much to battle for Israel at this point. So it's his son who's taking the initiative, his son who's placing his trust in the Lord. So we really are getting a very favorable picture of Jonathan here.
Yeah, I mean, thinking back to the way the previous chapter ended, Saul's army at that point was diminished. He had a larger army, but the waiting on Samuel had sent people scattering, and then you know Saul's attempt to take the priestly duties himself didn't help anything. So he's only got about 600 men, and from an earthly perspective, you could see why perhaps Saul is hesitant. Jonathan, though, it seems maybe knows the rest of the Old Testament a little bit better than his dad does.
Yeah, he knows that the Lord has promised that he's going to deliver his people through the king. I'd point out that Jonathan's name means Yahweh is given. And you know, you can't always kind of do a, you know, use etymologies of names to, sure, to teach something. But I think in Jonathan's case, he's a true gift to Israel. He's a true gift to David. And so the Yahweh has given him here as a valiant fighter. In contrast with Saul, who takes the gifts of the Lord and really kind of squanders them, he's going to end up destroying the kingship. He's going to end up destroying his own life, which the Lord has given, by falling on his own sword. Once again, this is kind of like Judas. You know, don't imitate Saul.
Right. Jonathan's confession of faith, I think, in verse 6 stands out, where he says that the Lord will work for us. He may work for us. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's you know, if you want to just draw out a dogmatic statement, kind of like a passage that you could use as a motto, that this would be the one you'd pull from this text. Kind of like, you know, in Genesis 22, the Lord will provide, right? Yeah. Something like that. Well, here, you know, I'd love to take this text and say, all right, this is a motto for my congregation. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. It doesn't matter whether we have 50 members or 500 or 5,000 members. The Lord is going to continue to save the people that are there, and he's going to continue to reach out through his congregation to save others. This also is going to be reiterated in this reiterates the event from Judges 7 when the Lord tells Gideon, look, you got too many people. And so you've got to go down and pair them out and split them out. And so it's with the 300 men that lapped up water that the Lord is going to save and send all the rest of the guys home on furlough. And I think this is also this scene is going to look a little bit like the David and Goliath scene as well. The Lord takes the underdog and wins the victory for them.
Yeah, so here it's just going to be the two men who are fighting against the Philistines. Before we talk a little more about Jonathan and his armor bearer, there is another person that's mentioned in kind of meanwhile with Saul that we should just pick up briefly. Talk to us just a second about Ahijah, the son of Ahitub.
Yeah, so he's the priest. We're guessing that he's probably the high priest because he's got the ephod. And that's going to set the stage for some Umim and Thummim action coming up a little bit later in the text. So his, you know, he's mentioned there. And then also the people didn't know at that point that Jonathan had gone. And so this is kind of set the stage for the vow that Saul's going to make going awry. So that's a key detail as well. So we've got Ahijah's there. Oh, and I'll mention this now. There are some ancient Hebrew manuscripts that indicate a little bit later on in the text that the ark was with them, but there's about a dozen reasons why it's not the ark. It's the priest's ephod that is with them. And then that also is going to, you know, lead to the Umim and Thummim, which are decision-making tools given by the Lord in Exodus. And so that detail is one that we emphasize early in the chapter and then pick it up a little bit later.
Do you think there's something to the reality that Ahijah is of the line of Eli, and we know that Eli's family isn't going to last? Seeing that as the religious leader or the chaplain of sorts with Saul's army, as opposed to Samuel, that's just another indicator that Saul's not doing things quite right.
I like that. I think that's a very distinct possibility, not provable from the text, but yeah. You know, it's a very strong suggestion. I mean, you know, there's just ominous signs all around, and so that would be one more of them.
Sure. Okay. So meanwhile, Jonathan is a bright spot in this whole section. So it's him and his armor bearer who are the two who are going to go up against this garrison of the Philistines. It sounds like it's a pretty narrow pass by which they're going to go up to this garrison. And talk to us about the conversation between Jonathan and his armor bearer before they attack.
Yeah. Well, the first detail is in verse 7, and the armor bearer says to Jonathan, "Do all that's in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I am your heart. I am with you, heart and soul." And so I just point out that this armor bearer is kind of to Jonathan here, as Jonathan will later be to David. There's this very clear friendship and trusting relationship between the two of them. Jonathan sets out a scenario in which they're going to go up and wait for a sign from the Lord. And we just presumably, if they say, wait, if the Philistines say, wait, we'll come to you, then they'll stay in their place, but they won't go up. But presumably, if the Philistines say, come on up, guys, then that will be the sign that the Lord has given them into their hand. And so he trusts that the Lord's going to be with them if they go up. And indeed, that's what's going to happen.
Okay, so they go and reveal themselves to the Philistines, and the words that the Philistines say, come back to bite them, right? The Philistines offer the challenge. You go ahead and come up, we'll show you a thing. And Jonathan takes that as the sign, and he attacks, and the victory is given to him.
Yeah, it's our idiom would be something like, I'll show you a thing or two, right? And yeah, they're very boastful and proud, confident in their strength in numbers and in their weapons. And they also use this kind of pejorative, those Hebrews, you know, they're dismissive of them. But they're going to find out very quickly that the Lord is with them. And you know, I don't see, it seems very unlikely to me that Jonathan and the armor bearer could have taken 20 men, 20 armed men, without the Lord really intervening in a supernatural manner. And then the supernatural elements will just continue afterward, when clearly the Lord is the one who's going to throw them into a panic, in the same way that he threw the Egyptians into a panic at the Exodus, right? And he clogged up their wheels, in the same way that you've got a great panic that occurs at Jericho. There's an earthquake, right? This is clearly the Lord intervening, I want to tempted to say rewarding their faithfulness, but it's like the Lord's plan, right?
Vindicating their faithfulness.
Vindicating their faithfulness, right? It's not about them, right? It's not about Jonathan and his armor bearer. It's about trusting the Lord's promises and then enacting them. And that's exactly what the Lord does. He delivers for them. And it's not Jonathan trying to seek glory either. Right. Mm-hmm. He's seeking the good of the people of Israel. The Philistines are their enemy. So he's doing the Lord's will.
Right. So the reality is the topography of this battle is described that it would have been a narrow pass. And perhaps that's more conducive to two people standing more of a chance against 20.
Right.
the way that what verses 14 and 15 read, this panic in the camp, the earthquake, all of that makes it clear that this isn't just a matter of better battle planning on Jonathan's part, but this is the Lord at work to give this victory.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to some, you know, the Lord uses Jonathan's natural, you know, smarts and his armor bearer's faithfulness to get things started. But this is very clearly the Lord's work. And it's going to be basically a sign from the Lord to the watchmen of Saul. And this is going to send a signal up. Hey, the tide has turned. This is now an opportunity. And yeah, this is, I mean, it's going to say that the Lord saves later, right? It's not going to say that Jonathan was super awesome. Although, you know, you get that kind of implied. But sure. Yeah, I mean, verse 23, we're going to hear the Lord saved Israel that day.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I mean, Jonathan is kind of super awesome already. We've had his dad take some credit for things that Jonathan has done in the previous texts, but now we see it yet again. This is the Lord's victory. As you said, a sign to Saul and his army is what's intended, and they see this, but things don't go quite as they should. So let's keep reading here. This is 1 Samuel 14. Now we're at verse 16. And the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude was dispersing here and there. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, "Count and see who has gone from us." And when they had counted, behold, Jonathan and his armor-bearer were not there. So Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For the ark of God went at that time with the people of Israel. Now, while Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into the battle. And behold, every Philistine's sword was against his fellow, and there was great confusion. Now the Hebrews who had been with the Philistines before that time and who had gone up with them into the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, when all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they too followed hard after them in the battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed beyond Beth Avon. And I'll pause there again at verse 23. Things are looking up at this point for the army of Israel. Saul's watchmen see, and they start to take into the account what's going on. Talk to us about the way this text continues.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of already mentioned this textual problem of the ark. And I really, Dr. Steinman in his Concordia commentary provides seven reasons why the better reading from the manuscripts here is going to be the ephod. And I mean, we could briefly summarize those, that there's, you know, contextual evidence that the ark remained at Kiriath Jearim until David brought it to Jerusalem. We're going to have Saul shortly consulting for an oracle of God. That's not ever associated with the ark. That's associated with the ephod. Thirdly, if the priest had put his hand on or in the ark, he would have died. Sure. As we say, Nadab and Abihu. And then we also, at the beginning of this chapter, had heard that Ahijah was wearing the ephod. And this is going to end up like getting mentioned again in verse 36 and following. So I really... You know, it's always a little bit challenging to discuss these texts when there's a textual problem, but the context here best demands ephod rather than ark. Anyway, one way or the other, it does seem that Saul, while he's conversing with the priest, realizes that, you know, we don't need to fool around with consulting the Lord anymore. I'm ready to kind of just go on and get into the battle. So he does, you know, kind of like turn to the Lord finally. We don't ever have Saul mention the Lord in any of this chapter. He doesn't like say, "All right, I'm going to pray now," or, you know, "The Lord's with us." We just see his lack of spirituality all around. But we see then that the Lord is confusing them in verse 20. The Philistines are actually fighting against each other. Again, this is very reminiscent of Jericho. And we also then see that there were some Hebrew mercenaries who were fighting with the Philistines. You know, later on in chapter 28, we'll see David actually serves as a mercenary. And the reason they don't let him fight against Saul is because they're worried that he's going to flip sides in the middle.
Right. Well, which in reality, David isn't on the side of the Philistines. He's more pretending to be the mercenary. He goes and tells them one thing and actually is killing all the enemies so that nobody's around. So yeah, but the Hebrew mercenary, you see the background of it here in First Samuel.
Right, 14. Right. And so there were some and they flip around and they're fighting, and they're also we're gonna see that there are some Hebrews that were hiding out that now, you know, come out of the woodwork and are actually join the battle now that the tide has turned.
That's right. Yeah. So the fear that you saw in the Israelite army in chapter 13 because of Samuel's delay and the way that Saul's actions didn't change any of that, things start to be turning now as we've seen Jonathan's faithfulness, and the Lord vindicates that faithfulness by beginning this victory for his own people over the Philistines. And things are looking great until verse 23. And then as you keep going, Saul does something very foolish, and we're going to talk more about that on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor Carl Roth this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Who does Lutheran Church Extension Fund serve, you ask? It's simple. We serve Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries and church workers with loans and ministry services. And it's faithful Lutherans like you, church members and church workers alike, investing with LCEF that makes it possible for LCEF to serve these ministries. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCF investments are not FDIC insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Thursday, February 27th. We're studying 1 Samuel chapter 14, verses 1 to 52 with Pastor Carl Roth. He serves at Grace Lutheran Church in Elgin, Texas. And Pastor Roth, prior to the break, we read and discussed through verse 23. We pick up the text now again with verse 24. And the men of Israel had been hard pressed that day, so Saul had laid an oath on the people, saying, "Cursed be the man who eats food until it is evening, and I am avenged on my enemies." So none of the people had tasted food. Now when all the people came to the forest, behold, there was honey on the ground. And when the people entered the forest, behold, the honey was dropping. But no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard his father charge the people with the oath. So he put out the tip of the staff that was in his hand, and dipped it on the honeycomb, and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes became bright. Then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food this day.'" And the people were faint. Then Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. See how my eyes have become bright because I tasted a little of this honey. How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies that they found. For now the defeat among the Philistines has not been great." I'll pause there. That takes us through verse 30. All right, so we have a vow by Saul, the response of the army, but then the response of Jonathan. Talk to us first about the vow that Saul makes.
Oh, this is just terrible. You know, there's an adage that an army travels on its stomach, and the idea that you could deprive your troops of food, I guess basically trying to slow them down, as if eating would slow them down or something like that, this is just defies all common sense. And then first of all, it's a bad idea to make this curse for that reason. And then also we see the self-centeredness of Saul here, until I'm avenged on my enemies. This is not about the Lord fighting. This is not about bringing glory to the Lord or preserving the Lord's people from their enemies. This is about Saul being a great warrior and getting revenge. Moreover, you know, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, thus I will repay." Saul here just wants complete vengeance for himself. His people, though, respect him. His soldiers are willing to listen, and they accept the curse. Now, it is very interesting. There's very, very few curses placed by men upon other men in the Old Testament. Normally you see the blessing and the curse from the Lord, but here it's a very unusual construction. There's no sanctioning for this. I mean, he shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah. So unnecessarily strong language from Saul, and yet at the same time, great respect for that language from his men. You perhaps see the discipline of Saul in that regard. Meanwhile, Jonathan doesn't know anything about this, and so he goes ahead and has some of this honey.
Yeah, this almost is structured like a tragedy, right? You know, somebody who, a good man who does something kind of like inadvertently to transgress without knowing, and then it's going to end up creating a dilemma. He hadn't heard the charge, but what we see is that if Saul had not made this foolish vow, the men likewise could have been strengthened. And as it says, he's brightened. That the text says he's brightened. And in some ways, this is kind of like his eyes are brightened, so that not only is he strengthened, but also so that he can see clearly. My dad's a moron. You know, he's not leading his people the way he should. He's thinking, you know, just about himself. And I mean, he does go ahead and eat. And then one of the men points out, hey, you know, you just placed yourself under the curse that your father had made.
Yeah.
And Jonathan observes then, well, my father's actually troubling all of Israel.
Yeah. He doesn't quite call him a moron. He's maybe a little bit more respectful than that, but he's honest about the situation and perhaps is given to speak a little prophetically more than he maybe perhaps realizes. All right. This, we were talking about this during the break, Pastor Roth. So here we've got a vow by Saul. We've got it's been broken by Jonathan, and he said, this means things aren't going to go so well for us now. We're kind of set up for seeing things are going to go badly in the camp of Israel. And what's the cause of it? Saul's not going to be able to discern this properly is part of what we're seeing as this text goes on, right? Is that kind of the idea here?
That's exactly right. I mean, I think we're going to have basically three possibilities for why things are not going well. And this is one of them. And then in this next section, we're going to read the second. And then I think you can go back to chapter 13. And, you know, I think it's distinctly possible that everything started to unravel there.
Yeah. Okay, so let's keep reading how things don't go well in the camp of Israel. Now at verse 31. They struck down the Philistines that day from Michmash to Aijalon, and the people were very faint. The people pounced on the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slaughtered them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, "Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." And he said, "You have dealt treacherously. Roll a great stone to me here." And Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, 'Let every man bring his ox or his sheep and slaughter them here and eat, and do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood.' So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night, and they slaughtered them there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he had built to the Lord." I will pause there again at verse 35.
Yeah, that was the first one, you know.
Yeah.
You finally got around to it, Saul.
Yeah, as opposed to, I mean, you know, I suppose you've got plenty of kings later who built far too many altars and those to false gods, but Saul just, he's not building altars at all. Here's the first one.
And this first one is built for practical purposes, right? So what they need to do is they need to get the animals up off the ground so they have some gravity to work to drain the blood out. Right. And so he's not really interested in worshiping the Lord here. That's, I guess, probably just a pretext. He's, oh man, my men are all, you know, doing something that clearly is going to provoke the Lord's wrath. So I got to figure out a way to deal with this.
Yeah. So it looking at the way the text goes, it seems that the part of the reason they're eating the blood maybe isn't all just a complete disregard for the Lord's word, but they're so famished and weak from not having eaten anything that they just start grabbing everything.
I mean, I've done some intermittent fasting, and you know, a lot of times it's not particularly hard to, you know, control myself right after I've broken my fast. But there have been a few times where it's just like I'm ravenously hungry and I'm just eating whatever's in front of me after I've broken my fast. And I think that's what's happening here. So we have an entirely preventable situation. I think that Saul, through his rash vow or his curse, had set the stage for his people to be tempted to break the Lord's word. It's not that he forced them to, but, you know, we can learn a lot from this. We don't put ourselves into situations where we're more likely to be tempted. And a good leader is not going to put burdens upon his people or his family that is going to leave them vulnerable to you know, possible temptations, whether to food or drink or sexuality or whatever. This is seems to me that we see it's one domino getting knocked over and the consequences just rolling downhill from there.
Remind us briefly about the prohibition of eating blood. It's a big one if you know it, but it, sometimes if we don't know the background, this may seem a little strange.
Yeah, I mean, this is foundational. We already see it in Genesis 9, but it's really stipulated in Leviticus 17. The life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement for the life. Therefore, I have said to the people of Israel, no person among you shall eat blood, neither shall any stranger who sojourns among you eat blood. That's reiterated in Deuteronomy 19, and then in Leviticus 19, and then Deuteronomy 12. You shall not eat the blood, you shall pour it out on the earth like water. So it's the blood is reserved for sacrificial atonement and forgiveness of sins. And then I think even more profoundly, though, the blood is reserved for the New Testament. And ultimately what's going to happen is the life is in the blood. Jesus sheds his blood for the forgiveness of our sins. And then under the wine, he is going to give that to his people as a means of forgiveness. And so I think there's something profound about the Old Testament setting aside of the blood for both redemption, atonement, and then ultimately pointing forward to the New Testament. But it's just, this is the only place in the Old Testament we see people actually breaking this prohibition. I mean, this really just sticks out like a sore thumb. I guess that makes it even more dramatic and interesting when the Urim and Thummim in the next section indicate this isn't the sin for which the Lord is withholding his help.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting that this sin doesn't really cross Saul's mind as the reason behind why the Lord is withholding his help. He goes elsewhere and the Lord directs elsewhere. So let's keep reading here. We've got all these things that are suddenly going wrong in the camp of Israel. How does the Lord direct things now? So this is now verse 36 of the text. Then Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light. Let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatever seems good to you." But the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." And Saul inquired of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him that day. And Saul said, "Come here, all you leaders of the people, and know and see how this sin has arisen today. For as the Lord lives who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." But there was not a man among all the people who answered him. Then he said to all Israel, "You shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan my son will be on the other side." And the people said to Saul, "Do what seems good to you." Therefore Saul said, "O Lord God of Israel, why have you not answered your servant this day? If this guilt is in me or in Jonathan my son, O Lord God of Israel, give Urim. But if this guilt is in your people Israel, give Thummim." And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. Then Saul said, "Cast a lot between me and my son Jonathan." And Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." And Jonathan told him, "I tasted a little honey with the tip of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I will die." And Saul said, "God do so to me and more also. You shall surely die, Jonathan." Then the people said to Saul, "Shall Jonathan die, who has worked this great salvation in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." So the people ransomed Jonathan, so that he did not die. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. It's a pretty dramatic text. They're one night, they're getting ready to attack. The priest says, "Hold on, let's ask God." God doesn't answer, and then this builds to almost killing his own son, and the people have him saved, and then it's like this just, oh, let's just go home now.
My goodness, it is really just the wheels are coming off very quickly, and It seems to me that, Saul probably is thinking that the fault is likely with the people for consuming the blood, because he puts them all over on one side. And then he really, I'm guessing, doesn't think that the fault is going to fall upon either him or Jonathan. I think he's kind of shocked when the Urim and Thummim indicate that. There's some very... Go ahead, please.
Well, no, I appreciate that. I think that's a good point then. So he is perhaps thinking, oh, this isn't my fault. It's probably not Jonathan's. It's going to land over there. And such that by the time it does land on Jonathan, he's so worked up and he's ready to kill Jonathan. There's no self-reflection on Saul's part at all that maybe it's his fault.
Yeah, I mean, this is... if we want to take a spiritual lesson from this, it's you need to examine yourself. Let a man examine himself and test yourself to see whether you're in the faith, Paul says. Chances are if things are going wrong, it's more likely to be your fault than it is the people around you.
Yeah.
I mean, this is always, because we're bad trees, we're oftentimes going to bear bad fruit. We need, even our even though we have the new man in us, the good tree that bears good fruit, we also oftentimes battle that bad old Adam. And so start by looking in the mirror and see if he's to blame. Saul takes the exact opposite approach here. We also see this is very unusual and strange that we see him using Urim and Thummim initially, and that's a decision-making tool. But then it switches over to Lot's, and he ends up seems to use the Urim and Thummim as lots between him and Jonathan. I don't think we can say with certainty that Saul is using these decision-making tools properly. We do get the results here that Jonathan had done something wrong, but like really, who's to blame for this terrible situation there? And it's really Saul. So I do think this probably connects us back to the previous chapter where Saul had taken matters into his own hands. He was not the one who was supposed to be making the sacrifices. He was supposed to wait for Samuel to show up. And here, I'm not 100% sure he's using the decision-making tools correctly. I think the blame really lies squarely on his shoulders.
So talk a little bit about Urim and Thummim. They're kind of mysterious things in the Old Testament. They come up with the priestly vestments, I think, in Exodus when the tabernacle's being given, and they show up a few places to pique our curiosity, but not enough to give us all the details as to exactly what they were or how they worked.
Yeah, so the first mention of them is in Exodus 28:30, where Moses is instructed to place them in the breastpiece that was attached to the high priest ephod. And so we got that detail about the ephod on the priest today. And those, they would always be there when the high priest came into God's presence. And we're told that they're said to be for the purpose of decision or judgment. We don't learn anything about their origin or their construction. They weren't manufactured with the breastpiece, with the ephod or the other priestly vestments. Most likely they were gifts from God to the people of Israel. It's interesting thinking about the name Jonathan here, meaning, gift from the Lord. And then we get these things that seem probably were gifts from the Lord. They're not going to end up getting mentioned again after the reign of David. But we do see a number of times in Joshua and Judges and 1st and 2nd Samuel where they are used to make decisions. Now, that the different thing, lots are a different animal, right? So lots were used to choose between alternatives. And, whether or not, so basically the course of action has already been determined when you're using lots. I mean, we've got a goal in mind. Now we just need to decide between alternatives. The Urim and Thummim actually were a revelatory tool that could actually give instructions to the Israelites. And it seems to me that Saul is not using the Urim and Thummim correctly here. He's using them more as lots. So I really think that this chapter is showing us that Saul is kind of maybe coming unhinged and is just not real. He's not pious, right? He's not spiritual at all. He doesn't know what the proper purpose of an altar is for. He had taken into his hands in the earlier chapter the sacrifices. I don't know. Maybe he's usurping roles of priests and and prophets that he really should not be, and he's not even being a good king.
Yeah, I guess I always thought that the lots that get cast that are mentioned referred back to the Urim and Thummim in maybe a less than pious way. But you're suggesting that the Urim and Thummim are only used in what, verse 41, and then verse 42 is a separate decision making, you think?
I do think that I'm following Dr. Steinman on this.
Okay.
That,
okay.
Know, he thinks that Saul is actually deploying these Urim and Thummim as lots.
Okay.
The language of lots in there, but it's not, you know, we're just kind of like, they're not separate things here. It's just all muddled together. Now, is it possible that there were some lots being used as well? Yes, but I just think it's just all very confused, and and Saul seems kind of panicked and not pious.
Okay, yeah. All right, so Saul is, as you said, the wheels are kind of coming off. He seems a little unhinged, and it grows, because as things perhaps are not turning out the way he thinks they're going to, here stands Jonathan before him as the guilty one identified in this manner. Jonathan confesses. Jonathan says, I will die. Saul's ready to kill him until the people intervene. I suppose just the thought of Saul about to kill his son because of a bad oath reminds me of the book of Judges and the account of Jephthah.
Yeah, and so interestingly enough, Pastor Apple, you and I did that episode together as well.
Oh, did we? Okay. How about that?
We did indeed. This is the first thing that came into my mind on this text. Yes. Jephthah makes an oath and it ends up leading to the death of his daughter.
Which in this case, the people intervene and such that Jonathan is saved, which is what you really want to happen in Judges chapter 11. And it never does by anyone involved. But I mean, I suppose there's that one shining, you know, silver lining here is that the people say, no, Jonathan is the hero of this story. We're not going to kill him. And they prevent Saul from doing his son harm.
Well, what's remarkable about that is, you know, when the Lord had given the warnings about the king, you know, back in 1 Samuel 8, you know, the people were adamant, we want this guy. Now, actually, they're kind of thinking maybe democracy's a little bit better. Of course, what would be ideal here would be like just simply trusting in the Lord. But
that's right.
But no, and we're actually told that they ransomed or redeemed Jonathan so that he did not die. This is that language of sticking your neck out for someone else and making a payment, and basically saying, look, you know, Lord, Saul, take it out on us, not on Jonathan. And so here the people are actually serving as a sort of type or foreshadowing of the work of Jesus, who's going to be our ransom or redeemer from sin, death, and hell. From all of our bad decisions, from all of our rebellion against the Lord, he is now truly our king, the suffering servant, who's ransomed us.
So just the way the text has progressed, up through verse 23, the Lord was delivering a fantastic victory over the Philistines. He has the Philistines killing themselves and running scared. But because of this bad vow from Saul, everything now has just come to a screeching halt. And rather than this being a huge victory for the Lord over his enemies, Saul's rash vow and his continued disobedience have led to this is where it ends. Everybody just kind of goes home at the end of verse 46.
Yeah, it's almost like a detente occurs. And so this is, again, illustrating the Lord is, of course, Jonathan appeals to the Lord's promise that he's going to be with his king and his people as they fight against their enemies. And in fact, he is, right? But at a decisive moment, Saul basically throws a wrench into the gears and just messes everything up with his rash vow and his, you know, misappropriation of the altar and his misuse of Urim and Thummim. And I guess this would just be a classic example of somebody getting in the way of the Lord's purposes. It's not so much that the Lord's unwilling to bring about a full victory. It's that the Lord had also said, if you disobey, then you are going to experience the consequences. And also the people are going to, you know, the king is the head of the people and the representative of the people before the Lord. And so it's absolutely crucial that the king be a righteous man and one who is going to keep the word of the Lord and enact and obey the word of the Lord. And Saul, this just continues the theme that we saw begun in chapter 13, and things are just going to go downhill from here.
Now, as you pointed out toward the beginning of our conversation, there is at least one bright spot about Saul in this text, and it occurs here at the end when we get a bit of a summary of other things that he did during his reign as king. So this is the rest of 1 Samuel chapter 14. We're starting again at verse 47. When Saul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them. And he did valiantly and struck the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malki-Shua. And the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merab, and the name of the younger, Michal. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. There was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he attached him to himself. And that takes us to the end of chapter 14. So a number of things there, Pastor Roth, set the stage for what is to come, especially when it comes to David. You pointed out that last verse. Saul's a good recruiter. He picks the right men for his army, and that does lead to plenty of military victories, as the text notes. We've got about 2 minutes here, Pastor Roth, to give us anything from this text and help us to wrap things up on 1 Samuel 14.
Yeah, so that last phrase sets the stage for David being recruited into Saul's service. So he recognizes that this guy's a winner, and his conquering of Goliath, and then he it's going to be a very ambiguous relationship on again and off again. But you know, we do have to remember that ultimately Saul does serve to preserve Israel, right? He does keep the enemies at bay. He prevents Israel from being wiped out, and so the messianic line is going to continue, not through Saul's loins, though, right? It's going to be through David's. And Saul is going to be instrumental in bringing David into the royal sphere. And then ultimately, David will be anointed as king and will be the father of the Messiah of the tribe of Judah. And so the Lord, as he again and again does in the scriptures, and as he again and again does in our lives, works through the sin and evil and brokenness around us to bring about his good purposes. So this text is discouraging in many ways, gives us negative examples to avoid, but above all, it shows God's providence and his grace. And in Jonathan, we see an example of somebody who we should imitate as one who trusts the Lord's promises and is blessed through the keeping of God's word.
Pastor Carl Roth serves at Grace Lutheran Church in Elgin, Texas. He's been helping us today to study 1 Samuel chapter 14, verses 1 to 52. Pastor Roth, thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me, Pastor Apple.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about 1 Samuel 14, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It's always a joy to hear from you. Join us again tomorrow as we read 1 Samuel chapter 15 to see how Saul does not fully obey the commandment of the Lord, and the Lord sends Samuel to let Saul know that he has been rejected as king. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk to you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.